Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we'll talk a little bit about healthcare and things that are going on there. We'll also be talking a little bit more about the case of Tyrone West, murdered by the police in Baltimore a few years ago, among other things. But before we can move on, I'd like to be able to say to you that the only one major anti-LGBTQ policy came out of the Trump administration yesterday, but I can't. In addition to banning all transgendered people from the military, on Wednesday morning, the Justice Department filed an amicus curiae brief or a friend of the court brief in a case before the Second Court of Appeals, stating that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 does not prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. Now, the lawsuit behind the case is one where a skydiving instructor is saying he was fired due to his sexual orientation, which, of course, would not be surprising at all. The Equal Employment and Opportunity Commission, as well as the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, agree with the premise that the instructor Donald Zarda is putting out here, that this sort of discrimination is illegal under the Civil Rights Act. This case has tremendous importance because currently it isn't explicitly illegal to fire someone for their sexual orientation. So this case could establish the baseline once and for all. So yes, the Trump administration is weighing in here to try to make sure that it remains totally, totally legal to fire someone because of their sexual orientation. The argument goes that since the Civil Rights Act does prohibit discrimination based on gender, that this essentially encompasses sexual or gender orientation as well. But the opposite side is claiming, well, people who wrote the law never intended for it to serve that purpose. However, those claiming the Civil Rights Act does, in fact, cover discrimination based on sexual orientation do seem to have at least one Supreme Court precedent on their side. In 1998, the Supreme Court ruled that the Civil Rights Act's provisions against sex discrimination did, in fact, also prohibit same-sex sexual harassment. So proponents say the writers of the law did not intend that either, but nevertheless, the way they wrote the law, it can in fact be allowed. So the upshot here is really just the remarkable assault the Trump administration appears to be launching, or not appears to be, is launching on the LGBTQ population. Some are attempting to separate out the trans military decision as part of a very particular set of politics around the budget, which may be technically true, but the willingness of Trump to make such a decision so fast definitely gives a sense of how much credence he's giving to LGBTQ rights. Now we have the White House endorsing discrimination against LGBTQ people by employers. On top of that, we already have the rollback of protections as well for transgendered students. Trump has also claimed he would support bills to and sign executive orders promoting explicitly discriminating against LGBTQ people on the basis of religion, and perversely actually calls that religious freedom. And it's also worth noting here, all of this discrimination is rooted explicitly in a desire to discriminate. Trump has surrounded himself with numerous advisors, supporters, and a vice president that believe anything other than heterosexual activity is unnatural and immoral. Make no mistake about it, this isn't about bathrooms more or cost to the military, about various forms of medical care. It's about trying to erase the existence of LGBTQ people as much as legally possible. Since the Charleston massacre several years ago, there has been a renewed conversation around the appropriateness of symbols of the Confederacy across the nation. New Orleans has now removed its statues to Confederate leaders despite death threats to politicians and even the construction workers taking them down. My hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia, voted to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee and has become a national flashpoint with various fascist and lost cause forces holding rallies to protests and even more massive manifestations of people opposed to hate and bigotry. And in just a few weeks, Richard Spencer will be there to keep spreading his hate ideology as well. The struggle also is heating up now in Fairfax, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. For over a year now, there's been a debate over whether or not to rename Jeb Stuart High School. Stuart was perhaps the Confederacy's most talented cavalry commander, although to history, he is perhaps best known for his absence at the Battle of Gettysburg that hobbled General Lee's ability to fight, and as some lost cause veterans would have it, perhaps cost the South a victory. Probably a stretch, but nevertheless, a major defining moment of his career. Stuart remains venerated by those who think the Confederacy and by extension slavery was a noble set of institutions, and because of his undoubted skill on the battlefield throughout the varying campaigns of the war to defend those institutions. Jeb Stuart High School, though, is one of the most diverse in Fairfax County. Students began to push over a year ago to change the name. As you might imagine, a school with many non-white people saw it as problematic for the school to be named after defender of slavery, one of the worst forms of human barbarism ever practiced. The students also conducted intensive research and found out it was actually worse than that. They found that the school was named after Stuart during the time Fairfax was participating in the massive resistance campaign, where many Virginia counties were resisting integrated schools, and some, including Prince Edward County, simply shut down entire public school systems to avoid integration. So not only did the name of a diverse school celebrate slavery, it also explicitly celebrates Jim Crow segregation. Now the school board in Fairfax appears to reach what they call a solution, to simply shorten the name to Stuart High School and say it isn't named after any particular person. Not much of a compromise. In fact, it's a minor victory for the forces that want to celebrate slavery and segregation. The opposition to the name change has no real case. They've pointed out that other schools have names of Confederate leaders and that the county's flagship school is named after Thomas Jefferson, a slave owner. Okay, absurd argument on its face. Clearly, the county should be considering changing all of these names, not just one. I'm sorry, the Confederacy lost, and their cause was unjust as any cause really can be. Slavery was a massive historical crime. We should not be naming or honoring any public building with any of these people, founding fathers included. History belongs in museums. Leave the Confederate iconography there. The House Rules Committee has prevented an amendment to the Veterans Administration funding bill from coming to the floor because it allows the VA to prescribe medical marijuana. This despite widespread increases in support, including from the Conservative American Legion, for the use of medicinal marijuana for various purposes for veterans. It's also a bit surprising because the same bill passed the House, or the same amendment really, passed the House previously by a 233-189 vote. Its companion measure in the Senate also passed overwhelmingly 89-8. And so it appears to be part of what a tiny number of Republicans are doing, really waging a war on weed, zealously supported by Jeff Sessions. Congressmen like Andy Harris are really central to this. And as people on the right and left in growing numbers support both medical marijuana and legalized pot, there's a remnant of hardcore drug warriors who remain wedded to keeping marijuana labeled as a Schedule I drug, which means it's just as bad as heroin. That's how the government considers it now. It also flies in the face of virtually all scientific evidence as well. Medical marijuana in particular clearly has medicinal value. In 30 states, it's now legal. 19 other states have laws that at least recognize the medicinal value of various cannabis-related products, like, say, pills or oils. The American Medical Association, the American College of Physicians, the American Nurses Association, the American Public Health Association, the American Academy of HIV Medicine, and the Epilepsy Foundation, among others, all support medical marijuana. Yet, a few idiots in Congress continue to try to block access to it, even for veterans, so they can keep their dumb views as law. Oh, and probably collect a bunch of campaign checks from the big alcohol companies who spend huge sums lobbying against even the slightest legalization of marijuana for any purpose. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here as we switch gears just a touch by Tawanda Jones, who's the sister of Tyrone West. And as listeners of this show on a regular basis know, Tyrone West was killed in 2013 during an altercation with police when he was strangled during a traffic stop in Baltimore, Maryland. Tawanda, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you.
No, of course, of course. And your brother's death back in the news around the country here, your family was recently offered a settlement, I believe, $400,000 from the Baltimore police. You are not, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong in any of this, you have removed your name from the agreement and are continuing to speak out and against what took place in the Baltimore police. Talk about why I think many people in these cases, you know, this is just sort of how they end it. They give some folks some money and that's it. Why are you not part of this settlement and continuing your efforts?
Yeah, so the reason why I had to withdraw myself, and it was really hard, because at the end of the day, I struggled with that because, you know, just because I withdrew myself from his case does not mean that I'm not going to pursue criminal justice charges and whatnot. But it was just hard for me to take my name off as personal representative of his estate and just representing him and whatnot. But the reason I did that was because they're never going to hush me. Nobody's going to give me some hush money and have me go away. And when I say hush money, we know how the city of Baltimore rolls, that if you get this money under these settlement arrangements and things like that, they want to craft the narrative and tell you what to say and what you can't say. And I didn't want to jeopardize it for my brothers. For my brother's children. Yes, I didn't want to jeopardize it for them. And so that's the reason why, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that's going to receive the money, not me. You know, so I wanted to be clear that I would not jeopardize it for them, because if I would have said anything, you know, like calling these killer cops names out and things of that nature, then that would be blown. Like, I'm never going to stop calling these killer cops out. I'm never going to stop telling people fight it and go to court. Don't settle out. Go to court. You know, and the crazy part was that really irked me was they sat my family down at the same table that they offered a Caucasian family for their dog that was killed by police. Killed by police, they offered them $1.2 million. $1.2 million. And you're going to tell me a dog's life is worth more than my brother's life? First of all, you can't put a price on a life. Let's be crystal clear. But I want everybody to know around the world, I'm on the right side of justice. And that's the side holding these killer cops accountable. Because to me, it never was about the income. It's always been about the outcome. And yesterday marked a significant day for my family, and not about the monetary part, but about the fact that finally that part ended, and now any walls that was up to as though the state's attorney's office was like, oh, we got, you know, we need to talk to this person, and all these walls was up, and there were certain things that we couldn't do and say, you know, because we didn't want to jeopardize the case. Those walls are gone now. Now the state's attorney can go and get any information she needs.
That certainly is very good to hear as well, and so hopefully things will continue to move forward, because I think you raise a great point there in terms of accountability and the role that these settlements play. Because on the one hand, you know, basically the city will admit, well, like, yeah, we owe you money because we did wrong. But then on the other, it's basically saying there will be no consequences for these people. And we've talked about this before. I believe these officers that beat and killed your brother, they're still on the force, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Not only are they on the force, they even got a pay raise. Like Ruiz, he went from making like $56,000 to $87,000 after he brutally murdered my brother and almost killed Abdul Salam on July the 1st and brutalized Darrell Hurst on July the 17th, and he's still working. And I believe now he's a supervisor of the police district, and I think in the West Baltimore area, but it's ridiculous.
I mean, it's shocking on so many levels that they can admit this. But then, you know, we also had that news that came out last year about how the lawyer at that time who was handling all these police cases, these settlement cases, ended up having these deep ties to this neo-Nazi group, which was shocking to so many people. And I think it just speaks so much, this whole thing, to how the Baltimore Police Department is really rotten from top to bottom.
And that was my whole point. Like, you're not going to. And then the crazy part, so I'm home the other day when I guess the media got the leak about the settlement. I'm home, and the first thing I look online in the news, and I see the, you know, the sister Tyrone West, she settles out, you know, and they're waiting for the state of Maryland to approve, and you know, this settlement for $400,000, and that was one part, and the other part's from the city for $600,000, so it ultimately adds up to $1 million. But at the end of the day, like I said, you're never gonna put a price on my brother's life, and I'm gonna sit down and the killer cops, they don't even be at these things. They got these lawyers, these same lawyers, I call them crooks in suits, that know that they're representing killer cops, and they were somewhere enjoying their family, and they want to send these crooks in with these suits on to sit down at a table and offer you put a price on your brother's life. And that's disgusting to me. It's horrible. I felt like they murdered my brother all over again. It's disgusting.
Last night, the 209th West Wednesday, 209 weeks in a row that you have helped others lead a protest in Baltimore. And it's really become sort of an institution in the struggle against police brutality, police violence and justice for a number of victims. Talk about what you guys do with West Wednesday, because I think that there's really, it's very unique of anywhere in the country to have 209 straight weeks of protest.
Yeah, so basically when my brother was executed on July the 18th, immediately we knew something was wrong with the system for the fact that it was lack of transparency. Like, nothing was transparent about what happened to my brother. Like, we had to track people down that were supposed to track us down. So immediately we knew something wasn't right. So immediately the very next day, after the lying detectives come in our house questioning us about them executing my brother, they want to know, they're coming in there with more questions than answers. And we're like, wait a minute, something's wrong. So we started going out to local spots in our community, like City Hall, to hold these elected people accountable, you know, in our fight, in our struggle for police accountability. And that's what we've been doing nonstop. So regardless of what the weather is, I don't care if it's a rainstorm or whatever the weather is, at the end of the day, these killer cops, they don't care what type of weather it is when they're killing and brutalizing our people. I don't care. I've never counseled a West Wednesday, even if folks can't come out there and stand me, because I don't want anybody to get hurt in this ice storm or something trying to get to a West Wednesday. But they could be crystal clear that if nobody else is out there, I'm out there. I'll be out there holding signs, but I've been blessed to have so many supporters. Regardless, we done stood in rainstorms, standing out there speaking out about what's not right, about what's going on in our community. And the saddest part, we always touch different victims, just like I would have never met Abdul Salam, nor I would have never met Darrell Harris or Shaquasha, who was all brutalized by these killer cops, the same ones that killed my brother, you know? It's ridiculous. So that's what we do. And we were even down City Hall just the other day. So it goes a step further than just West Wednesday. We were down there for that hearing that happened at City Hall about the 1 year mandatory minimum sentence about a gun. So, like, we always go out for the cause.
Yeah, no, I think that was quite the situation out there. I mean, quick thoughts on this. I mean, do you think this 1 year gun ban issue is going to make any sort of difference in the situation in Baltimore?
Absolutely, totally not. All it's going to do, bad enough, our brothers and sisters are targeted. Like, we have targets on our back. Like, you can't do something right, you can't do something wrong. And don't get me wrong, I'm one big, because we got to come up with a solution, right? Because too many people are dying, getting killed. Like, we had 200 bodies, and we're not even near the end of the year yet. Like, this is ridiculous. My heart goes out to all the victims involved. I'm so sorry that this is happening. But this is not the issue. The biggest issue that nobody wants to deal with is the lack of funds that are out there in our communities that are not available. They rather, like I say, put all these monies into bills and, you know, things like that. But they need to get to the top. Who are bringing these weapons to us? Like, people in my community, they don't even have enough revenue to get around the city, more or less go and get these handguns, these illegal handguns. So we need to control that first, and more so we need to control the department, the police department. And that's my biggest thing, because at the end of the day, like I said, the rise of crime did not happen in Baltimore City until the uprise with Freddie Gray. Until we all stood together for one cause, one purpose, one fight. Let's be clear. That's when the officers turned their back and they're like, you know what, y'all deal with each other. We don't care. And that's it. And they let this become the Wild Wild West. This is not Charm City. Baltimore is Harm City. It's really dangerous. Really dangerous. The city of tears.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us again here, Ms. Jones. It's Tawanda Jones, the sister of Tyrone West, who was murdered by Baltimore police. We are going to take a break on that note. We're going to come back with more on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the ongoing efforts by the Republican Party to kick tens of millions of people off of health insurance. And we're very happy to be joined here by Dr. Margaret Flowers, who's the co-founder of Popular Resistance and also the director of the Health Over Profit for Everyone campaign. Margaret, thank you so much for being with the show again.
Thank you for inviting me back.
No, of course, of course. The pleasure is all ours. And over the last few days, a lot has been happening. It's kind of hard to keep a track of, the repeals, skinny repeals, you know, process votes, the whole nine. I mean, give us some sort of overview sense, if you could, of what exactly is going on right now in the Senate over this health care bill.
Sure. Thank you so much. So, yeah, it's been a pretty crazy week. In addition to what's happening in the Senate, there's also been a lot of protests, which have been great to see. But basically, Senator John McCain was healthy enough to be brought back to Washington, D.C. So Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell decided to move forward with the process of trying to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. They first had to vote on a procedure to allow them to go forward, and Senator McCain and the Vice President Mike Pence were the votes that allowed that to go forward. And then they put out two proposals that the Senate had put together to repeal the ACA and replace it with the Senate version. Both of those failed, and so they're currently doing debate and expect that debate to wrap up this afternoon, and then they'll start voting on an unlimited number of amendments. So this is going to be a process that will go deep into the night, early in the morning, and who knows where it will end. But it looks like what they're aiming for is something called a skinny repeal, where they would basically just get rid of the employer mandate and individual mandate that forces people to purchase private insurance, roll back a tax on medical devices, and then they think that those are two things that are non-controversial enough that they can get all the senators, you know, enough senators to vote for them to pass that. What that means then is it allows them to go to the next step, because the Senate, well, the House passed one version already earlier this year of their repeal and replace, but the Senate declined to take up the House version. They wanted to do their own. So then this skinny repeal and the House version will go to what's called a conference committee, which is a small group of members of Congress from both the Senate and the House and from both parties that will put together like the different parts of the House and Senate bill into one bill that then has to go back to each body for another vote. So this is just a way, the skinny repeal is just a way for them to get something out of the Senate so they can move on with this process.
Well, I mean, it really just seems like at the end of the day, they're just trying to find some way to smuggle through, you know, some version of these bills that are stripping healthcare from tens of millions of people here. And that a lot of this is in some ways maybe sort of procedural ruses here and there to try to sort of hide the ball on what they're doing. And the sort of way the skinny repeal is certainly been put forward there at the end of the day. So, I mean, I think it's fair to say, I guess my question is it fair to say that, you know, despite everything that's going on, sort of the baseline bottom line is that this is still the same push we've seen since the House took this up to really destroy healthcare for millions?
Yeah, absolutely. And this political gamesmanship is typical for them to, you know, use whatever ways they can to pursue their agenda. So this is definitely about finding, because this has been so difficult. Like the Republicans, I don't think ever dreamed that repealing the ACA would be such a huge feat. And so this is a way for them to push that process forward. At the end of the day, we know that it's going to contain some of the provisions that are out there. You know, they're trying to cut Medicaid, they're trying to roll back taxes on the wealthy, and they're trying to make insurance more expensive, skimpier, and these proposals have all been shown that they would result in tens of millions of people losing access to health care. Now, there's a really interesting maneuver that one senator made today. It was announced last night. Senator Steve Daines is a Republican from Montana. And if your listeners remember, during the Affordable Care Act, Senator Max Baucus from Montana put in a provision that gave Medicare to all of the residents of Libby, Montana and surrounding Lincoln County because they had been exposed to asbestos and they hadn't found any other way to meet their health care needs. So he immediately, in the ACA, gave Medicare to all of those residents. So it's ironic that Senator Steve Daines is putting out an amendment this afternoon, and we anticipate a vote that would replace the Affordable Care Act with what we've been advocating for, national improved Medicare for All, as embodied in John Conyers' H.R. 676, Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act. And the senators, including Senator Sanders, are whipping against this amendment. They're encouraging the Democrats to vote against national improved Medicare for All. It's really an interesting situation.
No, it's extraordinarily interesting. I mean, obviously a ploy there from the Republicans to try to force the Democrats to show their hand on single payer and perhaps, I think, to cover their behind a little bit there if this thing fails by sort of being able to turn it on the Democrats being crazy socialist or whatever they want to say. I'm sure that's what they're trying to do. But I have to say it is very interesting because especially Senator Sanders, he's been saying for months now he was going to introduce some Medicare for All bill into the Senate that was going to be like the bill. And it just sort of seems like this would have been the time to sort of get this in the mix. Nothing there. And now it looks like the one sort of moment here, at least this week, for single payer will be one of all Democrats voting against it. And obviously they'll say, oh, well, this is just a ploy. But it also seems like, you know, obviously it's not going to pass because Republicans will not support it. So why not support, you know what I'm saying? Why not turn it back around on them? I mean, I think it's interesting, but your thoughts.
Yeah, well, our thoughts is absolutely that the Democrats should be voting for it. We've seen Democratic Party leadership in the Senate come out recently saying that single payer or Medicare for All is on the table. Senator Chuck Schumer said that this week. We've also heard from Elizabeth Warren, Dick Durbin, Kirsten Gillibrand. So if they really mean that Medicare for All is on the table, then even if they say this as a symbolic vote, they should be voting for it because that sends a message to the opposition, to those industries that are profiting off of our current system to say, no, we're going to push for the real solution. It sends a message to the public that we hear you. We hear your demand for a solution to the healthcare crisis now. And so this really, I think, should be a litmus test for voters of whether their senators vote for this or not, because you can't say that you support it and then when you have the opportunity, vote against it.
And what did you think of John McCain's little star turn coming back here, getting the standing ovation, big hug from Cory Booker, allegedly like a hero of some sort while coming back to cast a vote to potentially allow tens of millions of people to lose health care? Your thoughts about his time in the spotlight here?
Well, I was standing outside of the Capitol as his car arrived and as he drove by, myself and other doctors and health advocates were shouting, shame, shame. You know, my first thought when I saw how all the senators welcomed him so warmly is that this is a big club and we're not in it. It's a club of the wealthy and it spans both political parties are in that together. And it was really hypocritical that Senator McCain would be allowed, you know, I'm sorry that he has cancer. That's not something we would wish on anybody. But why is he allowed to go home and get all the health care that he needs and then the Senate postpones a vote waiting for him to come back so he can be the critical vote needed to take health care away from tens of millions of people? That is something that he should be deeply ashamed of.
You'd like to think so, but I think we know him a little bit and perhaps he wouldn't. You know, one thing that's sort of undergirding a lot of the discussion about single payer is sort of how exactly it would work. And in your home state of Maryland, there's some new discussion of this all care model, I believe it's being called. Interesting concept. Talk a little bit, if you could, to us about what's going on with that.
Sure. Well, Maryland for a long time has had something called an all payer system where the state is allowed to set hospital rates. And, you know, and that's something that they've done to try to control healthcare costs. What we're seeing right now, and there was a recent article in The Intercept by David Dayan talking about this, is political maneuvering. Ben Jealous, former head of the NAACP, is running for governor in Maryland as a Democrat and supporting, you know, single payer. What they're talking about in that article is there may be ways at the state level that we can try to heavily regulate private insurance and then let the state set rates, and that will possibly bring some of the benefits of a single-payer system. It's not a single-payer system. It's still an insurance-based system, but they're trying to spin it as if it would be some sort of backdoor to single-payer. I don't support single-payer at the state level because you can't achieve a pure single-payer system at the state level. This is something that we need to do at the federal level. I do support state efforts to try to expand coverage and control healthcare costs, but it's not correct for us to say single payer when we're talking about these state bills because they can't get all of those different pieces. There's too much federal obstacles in the way to get all the pieces into a state system. And that's why I think so strongly that we need to be advocating right now for a national improved Medicare for all. We want every person living in the country to have access to health care, and we can afford to do that right now.
Yeah, well, no, I think that's a good point. I'm glad you raised that. I mean, I know one of the issues about a lot of these state-level plans is you'd have to get some sort of waiver from HHS, and it just many people have said, and I think that they're certainly has value in this, that, you know, it's just extraordinarily unlikely that you'd even get a chance to do it from the point of view of a waiver, which you would need to get the federal funds and use them however you want. I mean, is that sort of the principal stumbling block to you, or are there other factors as well?
A big part of it is the waivers, and there's multiple waivers because our healthcare system is so fragmented. We have a lot of different payers, and so you would need to get federal waivers for Medicare and Medicaid. You need to get waivers to be excused from the Affordable Care Act, and to get that funding, you need to figure out how you're going to deal with the federal employee health benefit plan, and then also how you're going to deal with employers that self-insure, because there's federal law that it's called ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, that doesn't allow us to, you know, tell employers how, you know, what kind of benefits they can provide. So it does require a lot of actions at the federal level. And our view is that if we're going to be fighting at the federal level, let's fight for what we need. Let's all come together and fight for a national improved Medicare for all so everyone can have access to health care right now.
And I think maybe the sort of story of this whole thing, I mean, a lot to be said about this, but one of the, to me, the thing that maybe 15 years from now will be the most relevant thing when this is talked about has been this explosion of protests all across the country, both in the Capitol, in the home districts, I mean, really just everywhere. I mean, really this becoming a major issue that's really crossed quote unquote partisan lines, made this bills, all these bills unbelievably unpopular. I mean, is that still continuing apace here? Have all these different maneuvers, you know, maybe lulled people into a false sense of security, or is this movement still pushing forward?
You know, this is a really amazing time to me and to many of the people I work with who've been working on this issue for a long time, is that there's so much happening that groups that we aren't even in communication with are organizing actions and press conferences and protests. And the message, despite the Democrats trying very hard to promote the Save the ACA message, what we're hearing is stop the Republican repeal of the Affordable Care Act, but then move directly to national improved Medicare for all. So we're getting so many, you know, requests for us to support actions from different groups that we can't even meet them all. And we're just saying, hey, great, glad you're doing this. Keep going for it. And, you know, groups that even don't typically advocate for Medicare for all, housing groups, faith groups, they're all coming out really strongly. And I was in the Capitol this week when there was actions to disrupt the Senate hearing over this. So it's really exciting to see people really, you know, risking themselves. And also, if you aren't aware, the ADAPT, the Disability Rights Group, has been camping outside of the Senate building and did a very powerful action this week as well, where quite a few of them were arrested.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. ADAPT has been just unbelievable and the work that they have done. And we were privileged to have them on the show talking a lot about that. And I think it's a very relevant point you raised there, too, about the Democrats pushing this sort of Save the ACA message. Because for as much as I think the conversation in the mainstream media is how this will redound to the benefit of the Democrats in the midterm elections, which it very well may, it does seem as if the congressional Democrats and the leaders are really sort of playing – they're riding the coattails of a movement that seems to be, even by the self-described Democrats who are protesting, not completely under the control of any of these forces. And I think that's something that deserves to be discussed a little bit more than I think it is in the media.
Yeah, I mean, I think riding the coattails of social movements has been kind of the standard operating procedure for the Democrats for a long time. And we know that they've refused to put single-payer into their national platform, that, you know – in the House, we have John Conyers' bill, H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, which he's introduced every session since 2003, and that's considered to be the gold standard by the single-payer movement. That has a record number of co-sponsors right now. 115 members of Congress in the House have signed on to it, but they aren't out there pushing it in large part. There's a few of them who are being vocal about it, and that's because they perceive it as not going anywhere. So they believe that they can put their name on this legislation, get some progressive of credibility for doing that, and then not actually do anything to make it a reality. And basically what people are wising up to that and saying, no, that's not acceptable. You're going to have to do more. We actually want to see movement on making this a reality in this country.
It's sort of one of those points that it's like here you have a moment where perhaps the sort of discussion on healthcare is as wide open as it's ever been, and yet somehow the DNC has found a way to like lower their horizons. I know that some of them, there's this whole effort with all these different amendments and different things like that. And I don't know, you know, maybe some of them will expose the Republicans and make them look stupid, but a lot of it just to me seems a little bit besides the point here, almost playing a little bit to the tune of, you know, the more, quote unquote, more moderate Republicans with, well, why don't we try to find a way for people to, at least at the gubernatorial level, find a way for the both sides to, quote unquote, work together and so on and so forth. And I mean, it really does seem lost opportunity being promoted at that level when it seems like this is a major political opening, maybe to other political issues, not just healthcare as well.
You know, and it's exciting to see the debate shifting so much towards Medicare for All. We would love to see a real debate in this country about how we could actually solve the healthcare crisis, how we could take it out of the marketplace and treat it as a public service as it used to be. I mean, it'd be great if we could be talking about a VA type system, a purely socialized system versus a Medicare for All type system, which is socialized funding but still private delivery. That would be a fantastic debate to have in the country right now. And I think people are starting to push it in that direction, which is, you know, a good thing to see. And I'm glad to see that so many people are kind of seeing through the politics and how much so much of what happens in Washington, D.C. is really political maneuvering as opposed to, you know, really looking at what is needed and, you know, what the people really want.
Yeah, no, I think that that's, as strange as it may seem, something that's not a part of our electoral system or political system that is being interjected into it. Looking forward here in the next couple days, I mean, what are some of the milestones you think in the morass of this that people should be looking for, paying attention to, and keep a thread on as this plays out?
Well, I think it's definitely important to call your members of Congress and tell them that you support national improved Medicare for All and you want to see that going forward. Get involved in, you know, what's happening, you know, their groups, state-based groups, national groups that are advocating for this. And just, I think that we have to keep the healthcare conversation is going to be going on for a while because, as I said, they're probably going to pass the skinny repeal bill in the Senate, and then things will go to conference. That will take some time. Then it's got to go back to the House and Senate. So we're looking at this staying kind of a hot topic in the United States for a while, and so we need to keep interjecting our message everywhere and standing strong together and saying we need a real solution now, we need national improved Medicare for All now, and just continue to build that momentum, continue to do the actions that people are doing locally at their members' offices and in the Capitol, because this is a real turning point in this country when we can solve the healthcare crisis, and we've got to push for, you know, as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. Dr. Margaret Flowers, who's the director of the Health Over Profit for Everyone campaign, also a co-founder of Popular Resistance. So definitely please check out the campaign, check out the Popular Resistance and the work they do if you really want to connect with this and many other things. We're going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Pergier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Pergier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the 125th anniversary of the Afro-American newspapers, which is happening this year. And we are very, very happy to be joined by Mr. John J. Oliver, Jr., who's the chairman of the board and the publisher of The Afro. Mr. Oliver, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I was happy to have you. When I actually heard this was your 125th anniversary, I knew we had to do an unbelievable anniversary. I think the oldest black newspaper still publishing, or?
I think we're just second.
Okay. Well, I'll take that. That's pretty good. I
did. Philadelphia Tribune is the oldest.
Okay. Well, great to have. I mean, tell us a little bit about the history of the Afro-American newspaper. For those who don't know, we got a worldwide audience. For me, this is a huge anniversary, but give others a sense of why it's so big.
Well, we've lasted so long because we have adapted to the ever-changing environment of the media. But we started in 1892. It was started by John H. Murphy Sr., who was my great-great-grandfather in Baltimore, Maryland. And over the last 125 years, we've expanded. We're in D.C. We've been in D.C. for quite some time, probably about 50, 60 years. We have also expanded into the digital realm, which is right now the hottest thing. But we have been reporting on the African-American community 425 years. And as you look back through that span of time, you can see some very interesting things that this community has been subjected to, has endured, but also consistently gets confronted with. The things that never seem to change. The more things change, the more they remain the same.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that is a great point to be made there. And I should remind folks, theafro.com, and you can check out everything that's on there. I mean, the history of the Afro is so, I mean, it covers so many different realms and so many different pieces. I mean, for instance, something that very few people know, some of the greatest coverage of international issues that actually challenged a lot of the Cold War nostrums in America and presented original reporting from places like Korea and other places, the Eastern Bloc, that no other newspaper, black, white, or other, ever had at the time. Talk a little bit about the history of the Murphy family and their just deep, deep involvement in this black liberation movement, the civil rights movement, and really just being right in the center of all those struggles.
John H. Murphy Sr. was an intrepid individual who had 10 kids, five sons and five daughters. And all the sons worked inside the paper. You can imagine at the turn of the 20th century, there were some challenges faced by the African American community. Mm. We were consistently denied voting rights. We were subject to multiple race riots simply because of our presence. And in the South, it was extremely hostile to just about everything that today we take for granted. Mm-hmm. Those particular issues at the turn of the century really started to become, let's say, visible as a result of the reporting of the black press and specifically the Afro. Mm-hmm. We had reporters that basically spanned out through the South, as well as an occasional international trip. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, you would see an article pop up based out of Paris. And this was in 1907, 1908, which was quite amazing. But that really set the tone for the way we felt we had an obligation to the African-American community to make them aware of the challenges so that they could eventually develop the voice that they started to emerge in the second decade of the 20th century. Keep in mind, the first decade, we were not that far away from enslavement. And the generations of African Americans were really hesitant to be so challenging because they were afraid that, look, you gave me freedom, you can take it away.
Right.
But as the decades of the 20th century went by, that voice began to coalesce. It became a lot more forceful, and you started to see changes. And those changes really became quite evident as a result of the coverage on civil rights, but on many other areas. Mm-hmm. And so the black community really started to evolve. You got to the second and third decade of the 20th century, and there were major debates about this thing called Jim Crow and how the segregation of African Americans or blacks really were was depriving us of some basic involvements. That took a battle, and we had to highlight it. Just the idea that the military was not integrated until after the Second World War, and some of the affronts that the white majority simply were subjecting us to had to be reported on.
Mm-hmm.
There was a front page article in 1937 as we were about to enter into World War II. We were preparing to deal with Hitler, and a lot of black men wanted to be part of that. But the problem was is that white soldiers weren't going to take orders from black officers. And there was a front page article that had a in 37 that had a big headline that said blacks will not be basically having to pick cotton. They were going to send black officers to Arizona to pick cotton so as to avoid them giving orders to white soldiers, which was we look at, you know, we look back at that today. And we said, that's impossible. How could that happen? But that was the type of environment that existed under Jim Crow. And that had to, you know, so reporting these types of things really started to loosen the general environment. And the whole objective was to make the white intelligentsia aware of what we were no longer going to accept and to make sure that they understood that we are not against them, but we're part of the American citizenry and we deserve the same rights as all the other, all the white folks have. It was a constant battle.
Well, you know, it's a great question that I think is still, you know, one that's really relevant about journalism today. And I think especially in the era of Donald Trump, and that's the area of how is the combination, or maybe combination isn't really the word, but the balance between, or not even balance, but you know, the facts on segregation were so clear in terms of what was right and what was wrong. And even though you're a journalist and you want to, you know, be impartial, this is an issue that it's impossible to be impartial on. And I think that's a big challenge for the media in the 21st century to say, like, we have so many different challenges. And for the black community, many of them continue to be similar to the ones in the past. So how do you stay true to the facts, but still have that sort of journalism that isn't afraid to, you know, call the balls and the strikes?
You can't hesitate. When you see something that you feel is really an affront to the values and the culture of the black community, we're going to write about it. And we're going to interview the black citizenry for purposes of letting the rest of the world know that, no, this may be happening, but we are not accepting it, and we're going to object to it the way we've been objecting to all the other things that we were able to eventually overcome over the last 125 years. But the battle really never seems to stop.
Absolutely. Well, I have to just make a note of this for people who are listening. Great article on the top of the afro.com right now about African American women gun owners, which I have to say is a perspective that is not being heard in a lot of places, but extraordinarily relevant and very relevant in Baltimore with the news that we're seeing over the issue of the 1 year gun ban and what are the issues with violence in the community and how is it dealt. So very relevant to a lot of what people are hearing when they talk things that are happening in Baltimore and how it is. And, you know, I also wonder about the role of the Black press, and because I really like the point you made about telling the white intelligentsia what it really was. Also, the role of the Black press as the voice for black intellectuals. I mean, I think that's something that has often been lost, but, you know, it was something even a W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, wasn't able to get into the New York Times of the world every single day or bring that out. So the Black press was also really, I think, unique in the American press as a venue are also high quality intellectuals, even though this was a mass product that everyone could read.
True. You know, some of the most interesting things, going back to history again, are the debates between Booker T. Washington and W.E. Du Bois. We were just talking at the office this afternoon about the funeral of Booker T. Washington in 1915. We dedicated an entire issue on that, because the funeral in Tuskegee, Alabama, was so unique because it was the first time the article started out by saying this is the first time in noted history that segregation apparently does not exist in Tuskegee right now, because you had all races converging on the Tuskegee Chapel to honor this gentleman. And in that edition, we had a it was a commentary written by W.E.B. Du Bois. And, of course, he was noted as the adversary of Booker T.'s position on many issues. His particular acknowledgement of the contribution that this man made to the black race and to in his ability, that is, Washington's effect on the white race to begin to recognize the intellectual capabilities of black people and to change their perceived notions that they more or less continue to carry with them as a result of just perceiving black folks as just once slaves, was an essential ingredient in elevating the entire race. But at the same time, he took issue with the man and his position on education, and he criticized him directly with respect to continuing a caste system in education, which he felt was absolutely wrong. But as a gentleman that he was, he recognized that this man probably did more for black folks and was one of the biggest and best leaders of the black race, even beyond Frederick Douglass. So, but, you know, you have so many leaders.
Yes.
And you know, again, in the 20s and the 30s, there are W.E.B. Du Bois is one of the most often quoted.
Mm-hmm.
But the intellectual debate in the black community, particularly around things that we take for granted, such as integration, is an amazing event. You know, I mean, in 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt was about to become inaugurated, he appointed a gentleman from D.C. His name is David Houston, who was a principal from a high school here in Washington, who had also been a classmate of Franklin at Harvard. He appointed this gentleman to be the head vice chairman of the inaugural committee, which is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But that in reality really was simply his job was to entice black folks to come to the inauguration. So he sent out invitations to the black leadership across the country. And there were several well-known black leaders who responded in a negative way because they said, look, you can invite us, but are we going to be included? And you had ending up having a debate between three black men in 1933 about what really integration is. And all three of these black men were Harvard graduates, which was amazing.
It really is. And, you know, I think also just thinking about sort of the expansion of what people even think black folks can talk about. I mean, talking about having correspondence in Paris as early as the turn of the century. You know, my father, who was an older gentleman born in 1930, you know, for sure, William Worthy and the work he was doing was super crucial to him. A good friend and comrade of mine we have on the show a lot, Richard Becker, who's actually a white man, he told me that in the 70s, he would go out of his way to try to find copies of the Afro-American to see what they were writing about Angola and Southern Africa. And so this has been a controversial issue. Do black people have the right to speak on international issues? Martin Luther King was criticized on it. Talk about the Afro not being afraid to push into that arena and report on these issues of world import.
Look, the same problems that we have been dealing with for 125 years in this country are beginning to basically create the muscle in the minorities in the countries internationally, in the groups in these countries to begin to raise their voice in objection. The result is that the Afro right now we're fairly big on social media. We have roughly about somewhere between 14,000 to 16,000 followers in India alone.
Oh wow.
And we've got something in the neighborhood of 13,000 to 14,000 followers in Brazil. And, I mean, we're all over the world. And the reason why that is simply because of the fact that we believe that people respect and recognize that what the black population in this country has endured are now beginning to be the learned lessons to help these other populations of minorities begin to deal with the discrimination that they have accepted but no longer are willing to accept moving forward. And they're very interested in not only learning our history through the eyes of the Afro and the other minority newspapers, but also to see how we're responding
to the current problems, which are, again, very similar and repetitive, so that as to be able to forge their own strategies to address the problems. Because everybody, particularly minorities around the world, they want to evolve, they want to participate, they want to be included, and they want the opportunities that everyone else is enjoying.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this, because I think everyone listening has seen up to this point why this is an important anniversary. We are live on 105.5 FM here in D.C., so some D.C. area folks. How are we going to celebrate in the Baltimore, Washington region this 125th anniversary?
We're having a big gala, and it's going to be in Martin's on 495.
In Greenbelt.
In Greenbelt. And it's going to be on August the 12th. And we're going to just we have Margaret Shetterly, who is the author of Hidden Figures, and she's going to be the keynote speaker. But it's going to be a party, and we're going to have a whole lot of artifacts, and we have vendors, of course. But you know, we're going to celebrate and recognize a select group of people. That's two or three people in groups with our Clean Block winners will be recognized. But we're going to celebrate and talk about 125-year history of the Black community, and also, you know, just to celebrate the fact that we survived and we intend to survive for another 125 years.
No, great point. And go to afro125.com, afro125.com if you're listening to this, and you can buy tickets. You can be a part of it. You could come from outside of the area to Greenbelt, Maryland. Not that hard to get out of there. You know, just a couple minutes more that we have here. If there's one takeaway that you want folks who have never heard of the Afro, who just heard of it here today, around the world, to take from this, what would that be?
Check us out. They need to see our perspective, which is the Black perspective, on the news that we basically are presenting, so as to give get a specific picture of what African Americans are doing positively, and unfortunately, in some instances, negatively, and what Black community is subjected to for purposes of continuing their evolutionary campaign for equality.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming in, Mr. Oliver. And again, he's the chairman of the board and the publisher of the Afro. You can definitely go to afro.com and check out everything they've got going on. Afro125.com to get tickets to the excellent gala that's going to be happening to celebrate this 125th anniversary. That is going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to all of our guests today. As always, I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we are your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By Any Means Necessary.